This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we've got three sponsors for the show. Firstly, Jam Software, who provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education organizations. More about them at jamsoftware.com. Secondly, Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, AeroHive. AeroHive unleashes the power of enterprise mobility. AeroHive's technology enables customers of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their business. I'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, come in. How are you doing?
Beautiful day here in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
What's going on? You're wrapping up for the end of term?
Yeah, we are. Our younger students finish up tomorrow, and then our fifth grade graduation is next Thursday, and school is officially out next Friday. So that will be the 22nd. We get out. We always get out the Friday before Memorial Day, and Memorial Day here in the U.S. falls a little early this year. It's the 25th, and normally, like next year, it'll be like the last day of May.
What's the rule for Memorial Day? Is it a specific thing? Is it like last Thursday in a month or something?
Yeah, it's the last Monday in May.
Monday in May. Right.
Yeah, so the Sunday is the 31st this year.
Okay.
We got a little bit early this year. I always love that week, that if we had that last week in May off, because I feel like the summer's not started yet. So like anything I get done that week is like a head start on the summer projects.
Yeah, it's a bonus, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like bonus time. So it's like get everything done. Of course, the thing about doing a lot of software updates early in the summer is then they're just out of date by the time school starts. So you kind of have to wait.
Do them again anyway,
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. So we've had an interesting week. If you don't follow me on Twitter, I'll run through that. So last Wednesday, it was Teacher Appreciation Week here in America. So I called it, I didn't realize it was like a countrywide thing, but we've always had it at our school. And so we have like a big luncheon on that Wednesday. And after lunch, I had some teachers say, like, hey, we're missing like 11 iPads. And that's odd. Like, that's a lot to go missing. But I didn't think anything about it because we had subs in the classroom while all the teachers were at lunch. And so I thought, like, they probably got stuck somewhere. Who knows? Like, they'll turn up.
Yeah, somebody just doesn't know the procedure.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, like, I thought, we're all around. Kind of didn't think anything about it. We recorded the show Thursday. Still didn't know where they were. Friday rolled around, and I thought, well, they haven't turned up. So I started doing some investigating. So I went and pulled the logged into Hive Manager, for example. And I looked up one of the, of course I have like the serial numbers, but I just looked up the host name of one of the devices. So it was like BBS30 is an iPad. And it went off on Wednesday at 4:24 a.m. It hadn't checked into Jamf since the night before on the 5th. This was the 6th. So like, okay, that's odd. And so we went and started looking at the CCTV footage because we'd already looked at the CCTV footage from like lunch the day they went missing just to see, we didn't know for sure when they got missing or we're just seeing if we saw anything. So we started pulling our CCTV logs from that morning. And let me back up. We checked our access control logs first. We saw one of our custodians came in at 3:50 a.m., which I was kind of like inquisitive about that, but apparently that's like very much normal for him. He comes in very early in the morning and leaves early, so like there's a lot of things they do early in the morning. And so he comes in about 3:50, turns the alarm off, so that's why the alarm was off. About 4:11, we see some kids pulling on doors on the cameras. And we see them the way they walk. We see them in the shadow of another camera, and then we don't see them again. And at 4:24, those iPads go offline. So that is obviously pretty ironic, I guess it would be the term, if not troublesome. So we call the police. We also post – of course, we've got great footage of the kids. Like if you look on, like I think I retweeted it a few weeks ago, if you look on any of the local Chattanooga news websites, like we got pictures of the kids on the cameras. We start blasting that, and we post that on our school is in a neighborhood, like in the center of a neighborhood. And so there's like a they call it Nextdoor. It's the website. It's like a social network for neighborhoods. It's actually really nice. And somebody bought it recently, actually. And so we posted it on there, and it got sort of lighting up. Like, people said the same night, like, they had seen, like, some kind of strange things in the neighborhood. Some people said they'd, like, their door handles had been kind of wiggled, if they were unlocked, like, in, you know, late at night. And so we called the police, and they came out and filed a report. They got the serial numbers. They submitted the serial numbers to all the – like, are pawn shops a thing in Europe?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So,
yep.
Okay. Yeah, I don't want to assume. It's just, like, it sounds like it could be an American thing. So The way it works here is – I know in the Southeast, like, there's a network. They're all networked. And so there's, like, a database they have to run serial numbers through before they can accept an item. And so we submitted those serial numbers, which I pulled from Jamp. That's another great thing about Jamp. It's, like, automatic inventory. Pulled all that information out of Jamp. And so we submitted that, and my boss was on one news station that night, and then Saturday I was on another news station. They just wanted to talk about it and get the word out. They showed the footage, and that was it. I mean, we really thought we were probably they were probably gone. And now, these were older iPads, and so these were like the original iPad Mini, which we've had for 2 years. We bought them when they were pretty new, and so, if you know, 2 weeks left of school, they were 1 year from being off lease, or less than a year. So, like, if you're going to lose them, that's now the time to lose them. And my point to people was, look, we've had a lot of iPads over the past 5 years. And if I told you, hey, we've had 11 iPads broken in the past 5 years, you wouldn't kind of, like, think in your head, like, that was that bad. And so, not that we're happy. I was happy about it. But it's not like we lost, like, 11 laptops from a money perspective.
Yeah, it's not $10,000 worth.
Right. It's like, I mean, of course, the downside is our insurance was like $5,000 deductible, and this was like $3,000 hardware, and then the apps were probably another $1,000. And so I thought that was probably, and we were talking about how we're going to replace these in the summer, because we do need to replace them. That's a lot of iPads to miss. And then on Monday, like, my boss and I, we went to lunch to Subway, for example, and I used Apple Pay at Subway. Mm-hmm. It was really nice.
Jealous.
And Apple Pay is fantastic. And we come back, and like we see this guy like coming into the parking lot, like getting out of a car. Don't think anything about it. And I go into the building. I could go downstairs to check on something. And my boss sends me a text and says, "Hey, come up here ASAP." So I walk up there. There's a box on his desk with all 11 iPads. It's like, huh? That's strange. Well, it turns out the guy was a lawyer, and he had been hired to return them. And so what we assume happened was the parents saw their kids on the news, on social media, and recognized them. Obviously, it confronted them, and because they hired a lawyer, their identity is still hidden. You know, it's like, what is that like? Lawyer client confidentiality, something like that.
Yeah, you can't be forced to reveal discussions with your clients. Is that
right?
Real? Yeah.
And so apparently the lawyer told the people, you're better off to return them than discarded them and destroy the evidence, because if they're returned, everything's going to be a lot easier to deal with. So they were returned, and they had been wiped. The police wanted me to check and verify that. And then the police have actually come and picked them back up. And they are now searching them for digital and physical evidence. I think mainly like digital forensic kind of stuff. They said they have like tools they use, and apparently, like they mentioned, logging into website. But again, see, our challenge is that we don't actually have them on footage leaving the building with the iPads, nor entering the building, because we don't have cameras at every door. Just the main, we have like 9 cameras inside and out. And so we don't know for sure how they got in the building. And again, the alarm was off because we had a custodian here. We've got access control on a ton of the doors. So we're not sure if like a door was propped open. Like, we're not sure like basically what happened. Because we have a guy come through every night that is he actually checks all the doors, makes sure they're locked. So because it's a 100,000 square foot building. It's a very, very large building with a lot of doors. That's just old building problems. So even if we know who they are, unless we can find some evidence, I think it's going to be hard to get them, I guess, convicted of it. And I don't even know how much we would press that. They're like on the local crime. It's on the local Crime Stoppers on the news, basically. there's a $1,000 reward for information leading to the arrest. But they basically said, if you did this, turn yourself in. It's going to be a lot easier to deal with if you'll turn yourself in. Because, again, we did get the iPads back. And, you know, so it's kind of like a good ending to a crazy few days.
Yeah, that could have been pretty bad, you know, if they decided to go for the whole lot or whatever.
Yeah, and they made it all the way upstairs without ever being on camera. And I know the path I think they took, and we were obviously going to add a bunch of cameras this summer, probably three times as many as we would have lost losing the iPads. And so I think I know the path they took. My question is just like, which door did they get in? And there's a few doors I think they maybe could have gotten in. And so like if they had come to where any IMAX were, you know, the IMAX were at in a library, they would have come across the custodian that was here.
Right. So it's almost lucky that they didn't get caught.
Well, that's the question we have. Was this a more calculated plan or was this dumb luck? Because, again, our building is open, especially on the weekends for church. And so, like, they could be here under the guise of, hey, we're in Sunday school, walking the building, canvassing, looking for cameras very, very easily. And we've had some issues like this in the past, mainly external stuff, like with graffiti. So, yeah. Happy we got the iPads back, kind of a whirlwind a few days. Been good PR for our school, actually. I kind of jokingly said it was sympathy PR. It's like you're in the news without any controversy.
Yeah, you're the victim. Yeah.
Right. And I explained on the news, like, you know, yeah, we're a private school, but we're also a nonprofit. Like, we just don't have, you know, our 85% of our revenue is tuition, 85% of our expenses is human resources. Like, we're not sitting on like piles of cash. And to have to replace something like that when you weren't even planning on it, even if it is just $3,000, that's $3,000 that has to be pulled from something else. So,
yeah, that's going to take a bite regardless, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I haven't gotten the iPads back, so I got to get them like kind of back into our, you know, ecosystem. And so I emailed my Apple SE, told him the situation. He said, yeah, just email the VPP folks. They should be able to help you out. And so I haven't they responded back, and they actually told me that I needed to call enterprise support. And the lady responded back with, like, I think all you're going to need to do is to unsupervise the devices in configurator, and you should get those app licenses back, even if the devices have been wiped. I think that's what she told me, so I'm going to call enterprise support when I get those iPads back and make sure that's the process. I didn't know if you had to plug them in to unsupervise them from the ecosystem. I didn't know if like that would give you your license back.
Yeah, I think my understanding is that it will. Now, the fact that you've got the devices back means you can do that yourself. Whereas if you had never recovered those devices, you would have had to go ask an Apple to, you know, give you new licenses for the ones you'd lost. But I think even if the device has been erased separately, because you can plug in the device with the same ID to the one that had the license before, configurator will know that, you know, the device got wiped, but it's the same device that had the license before. Therefore, you should get the license used again.
Yeah, and so as a couple people asked me, like, how do they wipe it? Do you have activation lock? And so all they had to do was DFU mode it, even though they're supervised, because, and these aren't logged into individual iCloud accounts, so there was no Find My iPad. Like, you can't log in. We have like 80-something iPads. You can't log into like a single iCloud account and turn on Find My iPad.
Yeah, so they don't have activation lock enabled.
Right. Yeah. And it kind of worked out well. It's a good lesson for us about just some building security. And that's something we'll probably talk about in a future show, like the technology behind that. But it was neat to like kind of everything started with Hive Manager. And because that's when it really narrowed us down, like when those devices left campus. And that could actually be information they could use, the police could use, to kind of create probable cause that these kids are most likely the one that did it. Because I literally have a timestamp that says this device left the network at 424, and then we see them pulling on doors at 411.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I had not a similar situation, but a similar problem in that a device went missing in school this week. And in their case, fortunately, had just been misplaced by a teacher who wasn't usually in that classroom. But again, I was able to use the last check-in time on Casper and things like that to see, well, it was in the school on this day, so it's probably still in, you know, so we saw it was in school on Saturday. So it checked into MDM on Saturday, and then on Monday we couldn't find it. So it was unlikely that somebody had been in over the weekend and taken it out, because obviously nobody had broken into the school or whatever. So these tools are super useful for that kind of thing as well. You know, they're good for your inventory management, but also good for things like this, where you can use some of that information to do a little bit of digging and find out what's going on.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons like enterprise tools are handy because they give you this kind of information that you can see that consumer grade access point just wouldn't be able to tell you. We would have been searching through hours and hours and hours of CCTV footage. We have 9 cameras. You can only watch 4 of them live at a time. Like you can do the fast scrubber where it goes 4x playback. So we would have had to do like 3 rounds of that from around the time we thought they went missing.
That's a day of your life.
Yeah, well, we thought they went missing Wednesday morning, like while school was on, or Wednesday at lunch, not like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that would be the obvious thing to expect, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Jamf Software. We already mentioned them once tonight. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in educational organizations. They have a great app called Casper Focus that is really handy this time of year around testing seasons. Allows teachers from their iPads to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. If you want to learn more about Jamf Software and the Casper Suite for Macs and iOS, go to jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring the show this week.
I was dealing with a school. A school came to visit yesterday, and they were one of the conversations we were having across most of the day was actually the way that we deploy and manage our apps, because they were in a situation with they had maybe 30 or 35 iPads, and they were dealing with their IT department were taking a 3-week turnaround to put new apps on their devices. And they honestly didn't believe me that it only took me 5 minutes to push out an app to whatever set of devices the teacher specified across the school. So we spent a lot of time poking around the Jamf Software, the dashboard, I guess, and looking at different ways in which you can organize things to push out apps properly as well. So that was I need an affiliate program for that. I don't know, but I think I probably sold another Jamf installation the other day.
3-week turnaround time, like that's just trying to be slow.
Yeah, it's like we'll bring them in, we'll go away for a week, and then we'll maybe start doing them 1 an hour after that. You know,
I mean, I could do a whole deployment in 3 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I have done. You know, we can undeploy the old ones and redeploy the new ones in half that time. You know,
right? Yeah.
So yeah.
So saw some nice updates to Google Apps this week. The Google Apps iOS app specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So there's, primarily the Docs app and Slides got updates. The Sheets app got a little performance bump and a bug fix bump. But in Docs and Slides, 2 big things came. Number one is support for placing images in the documents on both applications, which is something that, you know, when you compare it to iWork, you're kind of like, well, you know, how long did it take? Like 2 years for that to happen. But it's here now and it works. So you can use a camera or you can choose from your camera roll. And then the second thing is in Slides has now got the ability to insert and edit tables. And as far as I can tell, actually, it's slightly more advanced than the table editor that's in the Docs app. It seems to me, I don't know if you get this impression, Bradley, that all 3 of these Google apps are worked on by different teams. And whichever one has done the most at this point gets that feature. So clearly the Slides team are a little bit ahead on table editing than the Docs team are, then the Sheets team are obviously doing a different thing. But it seems that just features come out in each one of these apps whenever they're ready. So those were nice updates today.
I still don't know that I love that being in separate apps. I know from a technical perspective, I know it's easier to manage that way. Because you have the Drive app, which is focused on sharing and organizing and things like that. But it kind of still is jarring on how long, like when you go to open a Google Doc, it literally has to change apps.
Yeah. I mean, we said at the time, Bradley, and I think it's probably right that splitting into separate apps means that 3 separate teams can work on these things now. Whereas when it was all just the Drive app, it certainly did not make the kind of progress that it's currently making. So I think on balance, it's been a benefit, but it's kind of a shame that they had to change the experience that much just to get the technical benefit of having separate teams working on the product. But, you know, they're making progress with it, and that's what I like to see. They're clearly investing in it repeatedly and making it really good. So things are coming along in the Google Apps world.
We also saw a nice update to the Sunrise calendar today that I believe Microsoft owns that now.
Yeah, the whole organization was acquired by Microsoft, you know, just after I started looking at it. I don't know why that was. Sunrise was a calendar app that we talked about when we were talking about Chromebooks. There's a really nice implementation of calendaring on Chromebook as well. So you can have the same kind of experience on, you know, iOS, Mac, Chromebook, Windows, and the web. And the key thing about the new version of Sunrise on iOS is that they've deployed a custom keyboard. They've written a custom keyboard. And I think this is a really cool idea. It's called Sunrise Meet, M-E-E-T. And what it's about is they've taken the idea of a keyboard and they've made it so that, imagine you and I were texting, right? And you said, hey, can we have a call at some point? When are you free? Right? This is a classic, you know, scheduling problem across different people across the internet. And traditionally what I would have to do is switch to my calendar app, look for some times where I'm free, memorize all those times, and then switch back to my text app and then type in all those times, right? Which is a huge pain. What Sunrise does now is instead I would stay in the text app, I would switch to my Sunrise keyboard, and the keyboard space would be replaced with a little representation of my calendar, right? Live from the calendar app. And then what I do is I just tap on 3 or 4 different times in the week and then hit done. And basically what would happen is that Sunrise would generate a URL and it would paste that URL into the chat, and then that would be sent to you. Okay, so your experience on the other end is that you get a link to click. It takes you to a web page that has a representation of those 4 options that I've chosen out my calendar. And you can tap one of them, put in your email address to confirm, and then I get back saying, you know, Bradley has accepted this specific time. So it's a way of kind of offering somebody a certain set of choices and then choosing one. And it seems really cool because the thing I love about it is that it doesn't require the recipient to have something very similar to you. Do you know how with all these calendar invitation things, like if you're using Calendar and I'm using Calendar from Apple, then it probably works okay. But if I'm using Google Calendar and you're using Apple Calendar or other way around or some other thing, the probability of success is always quite low with that stuff. Whereas this, it doesn't require the recipient to have anything except a web browser. But then the recipient gets an email with an ICS file they can import into their calendar. The sender gets confirmation of which one was chosen, and I think that's going to be a really, really cool thing. It's probably enough to get me to switch to Sunrise. It's really, really nicely done.
Yeah, because it's doing a lot more than just reading the local calendars on your Mac and, you know, iOS device like a lot of third-party calendar apps do. It's a whole ecosystem behind it. You could certainly see it being integrated in with the Outlook iOS apps at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Outlook already tries to do some things for scheduling with you, doesn't it? They sort of have that view inside Outlook where you can see your calendars inside the mail you're composing and then
yes,
offer some information like that. So this is kind of that, but taken out into every app through a keyboard. I think that's just a genius idea. Really like it.
Let's thank our second sponsor of the night. It's fine folks at Aerohive Networks. They unleash the power of enterprise mobility. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their businesses. It's deployed in over 13,000 enterprises worldwide. Aerohive's proprietary mobility platform takes advantage of the cloud and a distributed architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, simplified, and cost-effective networks. To learn more about Aerohive Networks and what it can do for you, go to aerohive.com. That's AeroHive.com. Thanks to Aerohive for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay. So, Bradley, what's the core of the show tonight?
So, we kind of following up on last week, we talked about long-term MDM planning. This week, we wanted to run through like a wish list of some things we would like to see. And really, with the device enrollment program and managed distribution, if your country has it, we've really got a lot of low-hanging fruit of the stuff that you could sit back and say, like, we really, really need that. And so there's a lot of things we're going to mention here that are not meant to sound nitpicky, but they're like little small stuff because that's how far the deployment technology for iOS has come. It's really, really quite good. And I don't know if this is as a result of Apple not having to build the entire ecosystem, or they can just focus on the APIs and let folks like Jamf and AirWatch and everyone else focus on the extra stuff. But Apple has come a long way since 2010. I was having a conversation with a company, you know, a couple weeks ago, and that's one of the things I told them. I was like, look, you got to understand where we came from. We had none of this in 2010. I mean, none of this existed.
Yeah. I mean, I always say to people who come visit or whatever that in 2010, you were doing the same thing for 100 iPads that you were doing for your one iPad at home. It was exactly the same technique to set up one iPad by plugging it into iTunes and syncing it as it was to set up all the iPads. And that was literally how we did it back in the day, was we had one computer in each classroom and the teacher would get a USB hub and they would plug in seven iPads at a time and they would sync it through iTunes. And that was how apps got out. And today I just press a button and apps magically appear all over the school. So that's kind of the step that we've made, and with a few, you know, steps in between there. But I think the deployment story right now is, I think it's pretty strong in the situation where the individuals can have their own Apple ID. But what's been clear over the past sort of year and a half of having the volume purchase managed distribution system is that in situations where organizations have to make a lot of Apple IDs or they have users that are too young to have an Apple ID, the current system is still problematic. So what Apple provided was this feature where you could notionally make an Apple ID for an under 13 user, but it requires a step where the Apple has to send an email to the person's parents. They have to then confirm something, and then things can go on from there. And what I've heard from people who have worked in school districts where this has been tried is that the completion rate on those confirmations from parents is typically very low. You know, and I say very low, it's like 60%, but it's nothing like the 100% it would be if you were making it yourself. You know, I don't get a 60% success rate in creating my Google Apps Apple IDs, right? So that's something under my control and it works perfectly well. Whereas when you bring in multiple other people into this process of getting you up to 100% working Apple IDs, it starts to become very tricky and a lot of management required, and that's a very unscalable process. So I think this idea that you've put down, Bradley, of pushing apps without an active Apple ID is going to help a lot of people. This is one of the biggest low-hanging pieces of fruit, I would say.
Yeah, and it's not just about schools, too. This is like for kiosk, for a lot of like car dealerships. I think the there's a car dealership in Chattanooga that they're nationwide. I don't even remember the name, but they all use them as well to look up information about your trade-in and about the car you're buying. It's really any non-personalized deployment. So it can be shared deployments in schools. You know, your cash registers, mobile cash registers, any of that stuff where you can push applications without an active Apple ID. And so, yeah, that's like, you're right, that's probably the lowest hanging fruit that's left. And I'm sure if that does come, which we hear rumors that it does, it'll also be through your MDM technology.
Yeah, I think it's quite clear that MDM is still going to be the basic front end to all these services. But the work that I had to do last summer to kind of go through and make Apple IDs for every user and so on, that work, you know, it wasn't intractable, but it was pretty tedious, to be honest. I ended up writing a keyboard macro, a keyboard maestro macro to automate going through, clicking through iTunes. And there's something like 25 or 30 different actions in that macro just to go through all the screens in iTunes to make a new Apple ID. But it was worth doing because it saved me a lot of time in the end. I think that's going to be the biggest one by far. They'll help the most people. And the rest is kind of would be nice to have compared to that.
Next thing is to lock the application layout. And these are really the two and three really together. We have control the application layout and then lock it from MDM. And I'm thinking like the screen when you plug up to iTunes where you can move stuff around, move apps around. I would like to be able to control that and to lock it. And it's not just like me wanting ultimate control, but it's just like, again, going back to kiosk and car dealerships, like you don't want, like if you have a museum kiosk with an iPad in a stand, you don't want people to be able to move the apps around. You just maybe want the apps to be on the dock and everything else to be in a folder called unused, and you just want it to stay there.
Yeah, I can see a case for both capabilities. You know, if you're having a truly personalized deployment, why not let people just do what they want with their own device, because it is only affecting them really. But then what would also be nice is to be like, one of the things that I kind of run into a lot, Bradley, is like, you know, students come to the school during the year and I have to go through and set up one device using the same procedure that I would do for all the rest But I've got, and they have to get a similar setup. And it would be nice if you could sort of say, well, this is the stamp for, you know, all of our devices. Make it look like this to start with. And even if you just manage that setting one time, and then the user can change it after that, you know, that would be another kind of intermediate level for people who are trying to give out a nice experience to start with, but then the student might take it on themselves and set up however they want in the future.
Yeah, it's kind of like a template-based install.
Yeah.
Because this is the Cedars install. Let's make it so.
Yeah. It's kind of what we used to have with OS X Server and Macs. Well, I suppose we still have it, but we don't have it. Which was you could set individual preferences, and you could say, manage this preference once or always. And what would happen is when you set or changed it, it would set every user to have that setting the first time. And then if the user wanted to change it away from that later, it wouldn't change it or wouldn't overwrite it again. So something like that is maybe quite a nice way to do that.
Next thing on the list is to hold and or push iOS updates. And I've kind of come around a lot of this. I used to want to push, but now I've just learned that it's probably best to maybe wait a month on a lot of these updates, the major ones. And so I would love to be able to say, like, device is enrolled in my MDM. No one can install anything past this until I allow it.
Yeah, particularly when you are getting, I suppose the thing, the one that I always want to hold on, Bradley, is when, say, like the upgrade to iOS 8, where once you'd upgraded, you had to go through a number of steps in the setup assistant to get back to running. Okay, there are some updates where that doesn't happen, and you just run the update and then it's back up and running. But, you know, there was the upgrade to iCloud Drive, and sometimes they ask you to, you know, allow app developers to get diagnostics and different things like that. And sometimes you want to, you know, do that under a bit of control, whereas the small point updates, you just want to push them. So sometimes that's the kind of thing that I think would be very useful. I think probably, Bradley, this is, of all the things we're going to talk about tonight, this is the one that you have almost no chance of getting. Because if there's one thing Apple doesn't want, it's people holding back on OS updates. But, I mean, to be honest with you, I have been this week updating devices from iOS 7 in our school because we've just held off iOS 8 for so long because it's been so bad up until really iOS 8.3. So I had kids coming up from iOS 7.1, you know, today. I did that today, literally today. So, holding and pushing iOS updates, I think if you gave people the ability to hold, I think you would see a lot of people holding. And I know from experience of iOS 7 and iOS 8 that when iOS 9 comes around, I will not be pushing anybody to update very quickly. In fact, I'll probably be encouraging people not to update very quickly just because the experience that we've had so far has been pretty rough.
And you can block those updates on your campus through your own Wi-Fi network, but of course that doesn't affect it when it goes home or off campus. And, you know, if it's a really personalized deployment, you can offer your suggestion. And if they have bugs, like, you can say, look, I told you to wait.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you can try updating if you do have a problem with the old version. But one of the things that's really kind of that makes this difficult, even if you wanted to do it, is that a lot of the app updates require a newer version of iOS, right? So the iWork applications are very closely tied to the version of the OS that they're running on. So what was prompting me to update one particular pupil today was he didn't have Keynote on his iPad for whatever reason. I don't know if he'd had it and deleted it or whatever, but he had it in the purchase tab because it had been assigned to him. And he was trying to download it again, and it kept just refusing to download. And I was like, well, why is it refusing to download? And the reason was because the current version of Keynote in the App Store requires iOS 8 point something. I don't know what the exact version is. And he was on 7 point something. So he had to get updated because he needed this app, and the app didn't run on the version of the OS that he had on his device. So that kind of close tying of Apple's apps with Apple's OS is kind of, that makes that strategy quite difficult, even if you wanted to do it.
Yes. Before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Now, Shobi Basic is free, so if you want to get started, you can get started with all your students today. very, very easily, just a few minutes, go to showbie.com or search for Showbie in the App Store. That's S-H-O-W-B-I-E. And now if you want to look at Showbie Pro, you can get some additional features with the Pro version upgrade. And if you buy 5 licenses, they will give you an additional 5 for free for a year. So go to showbie.com/out of school for more details. Again, thanks to Showbie for sponsoring the show this week. So the next thing was to force app updates. And of course, this is a setting in the store settings, but basically you can say, look, this is a major bug fix in this app. I want you to push it to every device right now, regardless of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that could certainly be useful, particularly in times where, you know, say there is a new major version of Keynote, let's say, and one of the things that's important is, you know, if you are going to a new major version, often the file format is incompatible with the older version or whatever. So getting everybody to move on to the newest version of Keynote at that time is quite useful. Although you might want to have a setting that says, if you're not in the middle of a presentation right now, don't push the new. This isn't Windows, you know. So I think that's certainly a useful thing. Or scheduled force app updates. So you could say, like, you know, I want to update all the apps on these devices, but I want it to happen at, say, 4 p.m. when we reckon most people are going to be stopped working or whatever.
Next thing is something we'll never get is love to see an iCloud for schools. So, like, pooled storage, email hosting, easier iWork collaboration because you'd know their account. And so I was thinking, like, this morning as I was driving into work, like, how, if that was the case, how much easier would iOS device setup be? Because you would just sign in with your iCloud account, and that would be your school email, your backup, all your syncing. Like, it would just be one account attached to the device.
Mm-hmm.
That would be incredibly easy.
Instead of two or three.
Right, because you have your iCloud account, but then you have your school email and, you know, so on.
Here's my question for you, though, Bradley. What would it take for you to actually adopt that? Say that did come out at WWDC. When would you switch to it?
Once somebody else did.
Good answer. Yeah, it's not going to be me that does it for you, though, I'm afraid. I think that's – I can certainly see, you know, having some kind of dashboard for making iCloud or Apple IDs would be really powerful. But whether I would actually like point my MX records for the school to Apple rather than to Google, I'm not sure I would do that anytime soon. But it would be good to have, you know, a way to at least make the Apple IDs, if not actually do the whole system in one go.
You want to take the next one?
Yeah. This is an interesting question. The idea is tracking and reporting time on apps. So a large number of the things that I'm kind of interested in, Bradley, are things where what I want is I want Apple to gather more data on the device and deliver it to my MDM through the MDM protocol. And one of the things that I think would be very interesting would be to track and report how much time the user spends on specific apps. Okay, so you could see, well, you know, an MDM dashboard could show you, you know, this user spent 25% of their time in school today on Safari, and then 15% on Pages, and 12% on Keynote, and 8% on YouTube or whatever. I think that would be a useful thing to have in certain situations. And where this came from was, I told you I had a school visit on Wednesday, and we were talking about the culture of management in the school, and how instead of just blocking everything or locking everything down, the approach that I take through using tools like Jamf and Aerohive is to be able to monitor and then, you know, detect if something anomalous is happening, rather than trying to guarantee that nothing strange will ever happen. So with Casper, I can see, you know, what apps have people got installed on their device, have a look at that list, see if there's anything that might be concerning in that list. And similarly with Aerohive, I can look at Hive Manager and I can see, well, here are the top 10 users for YouTube this week, and here are the top 10 users for the web, and the top 10 users for Facebook and whatever. And have a look at that and see, you know, are the same people consistently appearing right up there all the way through? Or, you know, and I've used that in the past as a way to find out if people are, you know, deliberately wasting time or deliberately eating up bandwidth or whatever. And having a way to just look at the kind of time people have spent on specific apps in school would be, I think, really, really powerful.
Yeah, that's some of the information that Kirby can do for the Kirby installed devices. And, of course, that doesn't obviously work when you're on campus. But it's interesting to see. Like, those emails are interesting. My boss, I remember last year, really got onto Sun for being on Instagram too much. And one of the Kirby's kind of mantras is to help curb screen time. And his son's actually, through seeing that information, has like started to curb his screen time, like took a week detox from social media. And it's like the more of that data you can see, the kind of shocking it is how much you spend, you know, with your nose on the screen. And that's one of the things I've really enjoyed about the Apple Watch, is that it's not a device I keep my nose in.
Yeah, because your arm's not strong enough to hold up.
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah. I think one of the things about that is that with obviously with Kirby, what they're doing is they're logging that information at a network level. So if your app is not a networking app, then that won't show up as time used. Is that right?
That's correct. It's only internet-based apps.
Yeah. So, for example, time spent on Keynote or iTunes U or something like that would probably not show up in the same way. So that's why I'm kind of saying, well, it's something that Apple would have to do at the device level, is to look at how long each app was running or active in the foreground. But I think that would be useful for schools, not necessarily with an implication that we're going to block it or anything, but just to be informed. I think that's really the culture that is important, is for administrators to be informed of what's going on in their school. And then it should be up to the school to decide what steps are going to be taken about that. You know, maybe I'm not going to do anything about it, but just if I can know who's really on task and who's not, maybe we're just going to have a conversation with the class about being on task, or, you know, when is it appropriate to play games and when is it not? Questions like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's useful.
Next thing is lock to a set of apps, not just one. And I had not thought about that until you written that down. And so it's kind of like the guided access API, but with more options.
Yeah. So the problem with, you know, Casper Focus, like we talk about every week on the show, is a really powerful app for, as long as you are in a situation where the task that you want to achieve in the classroom is achievable with exactly one app and no more. And I find it increasingly rare, outside of a test situation, that is actually how we work. It's very much the case that we often work across several apps. So, for example, today I was teaching about internet censorship, and then I was talking a little bit about how using public Wi-Fi is quite a risky thing to do, and you should maybe think about using a VPN, for example. So I had I set off the kids on a task, these kids were like 9 and 10, to make a poster to try and encourage people to use VPN, right, kind of public service advert. And, you know, they were doing that in different apps. Some were using Keynote, some were using brushes and different things, but all of them were also referring back to Safari and different things as well, some notes and things that we had. So it wasn't possible for them to finish that task using just any one app. They needed to use two or three different apps to get that task done. So being able to say, you know, maybe we want to lock down to, you know, these 10 apps or this particular folder or something like that, rather than just saying just one app and no others, I think that would be you would see that being used a lot more, and it would bring a lot more kind of flexibility to apps like Casper Focus as well.
It's you could say, I mean, that would be almost great for testing, because let's say your testing schedule had you use more than one app, then yeah. So next thing on the list is push apps at specific times. So this might be to where you want apps to be pushed out at noon because you know your students are at lunch and you know that it won't be interfering with anything, and the network resources are already be a little bit lower anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing, the thing that we've discovered trying to push apps out using Casper this year is that, you know, say a teacher comes into me at 8 in the morning and says, hey, can I get this app? And I'll go straight onto my, you know, Casper dashboard and say, yeah, okay, assign this app to this class. Well, all those kids' iPads are upstairs, you know, asleep, or they're off campus. And whenever that push happens, those iPads are not always awake and ready to, you know, automatically download the app. So what I'd like to be able to do is say, okay, schedule, you know, for when the kids are going to start their lesson, you know, maybe 9:30, they'll have all got their iPads out and open for something or other. I know that they'll be online, and then push at that point. That's possibly even doable today just by the NDM itself, rather than requiring anything new from Apple. But I think it would be a nice feature either way.
Next thing is force initiate iCloud backup. And this could really be kind of tied in with the previous one, where you could say, you know, hey, when the next time this is on Wi-Fi, do it. Please, you know, do it now. Don't require power, just backup.
Yeah. This request comes from learning that a good number of people turn the Wi-Fi off when they go to bed at night. I had no idea this was a thing that people did because I've never done it in my life. But apparently, I wouldn't say it was the majority of people, but I would estimate probably about 40% of the families in our school turn their Wi-Fi off when they go to bed at night. For whatever reason, I don't know. Maybe they're scared of something going on fire. Maybe they're scared of their kids being on the internet all night or whatever. I'm not sure. But that obviously interferes with the iOS way of doing a backup, which is to be plugged in and locked at some point overnight. It's fine as long as you plug in your iPad at night and you don't turn your Wi-Fi off. But if you turn your Wi-Fi off at 9 o'clock and then at 10 o'clock you put your iPad on to charge, then a lot of people, you know, for these 40% might never actually get a backup done in reasonable time. So what would be really cool is to be able to say, look, you know, once a week at, let's say, you know, 10 in the morning, let's just have everybody who doesn't have a very current backup to make a backup when I know that they're in school on our network and that we could cope with that. I think that would be a very useful thing to have too.
Next thing is integration with iBeacons to trigger MDM activity.
Mm-hmm. So this came out of a conversation I had with some folks at Jamf where they have got support for iBeacon for certain things. So they can do things already where if your device sees an iBeacon, then your Casper MDM will push specific configuration profiles to the devices that can see the iBeacon. But that's about all they can do right now. And one of the things that we thought of that would be really cool would be able to, for example, you know, if it was possible for the MDM to force a backup, we could have an iBeacon at the door that says, you know, as you walk past this door and see this iBeacon, I want your backup to start triggering if it's out of date, let's say, or something like that. Or as you walk in the door or walk around the school, I would like your device to check in its inventory to the MDM server. So the device might check in more frequently as a student walks around the school. You might get slightly more up-to-date information in the MDM as well. I can think of a bunch of other things that you could do with that, but those are just a couple of examples.
Report geolocation at check-in. Now, this could technically be possible now by if you, yeah, I know there's some ways like they can tell what ISP a device comes in. So you could probably get down to like the city it was in most likely, but there's going to be, you know, I'm looking for like, I want to know exactly where this device is in when it checks in.
Yeah. Meraki tries to do that. So if you look at a device check-in in Meraki, it will try and do a GeoIP. But I found in the UK that was actually quite inaccurate because some of the big, ISPs, I knew that these devices were in Greenock, but they were being reported as being from Manchester because that was where the IP block was registered at. So actually using location services to get either an exact or a rough location, I think would be very useful just as a way to have that additional field in there rather than trying to work it out from GeoIP.
And I could certainly see that being a supervised only
feature. Oh, absolutely, yeah. And probably requiring user acknowledgement as well, yeah.
Next to the last thing is ping device. And yeah, this has been, is actually a nice feature you can do from the Apple Watch is you can ping your iPhone. And that's been a nice feature. Phone was stuck on the couch one day, no idea where it was at, rather than have to go log in to find my iPhone app on the computer or the website. I was able to ping my phone from my watch, and that was nice. And like you mentioned earlier, when you're looking for devices around campus, it would be nice to be able just to ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, just have that be without necessarily having to have an active iCloud account. Just have the MDM have access to that feature as well. I think that would be so many times I would use that.
Oh yeah,
you know, Jamf would have to make an Apple Watch app that just had like all your devices, and you just make one of them beat from your watch. That would be amazing. Yeah.
No, that's a perfect use of a watch app. Last one is a fantastic idea. Fantastic app whitelisting and blacklisting.
Yeah, this is a live issue, to be honest with you. And basically what it is that the reason I want this is because we make a decision in the school to put an across-the-board blanket restriction that says no apps that are 17-plus rated. And therefore, you know, 12-plus and below is fine. But the problem is that specific apps, individual apps, will sometimes change their rating. And this has happened several times this year where apps that we have used and depended on for years have suddenly gone to 17 plus ratings. And even as they're deployed on our devices, when a new update comes out that carries a higher rating, the practical effect of this is that the update will never complete. So the old version can be used still, but the update will remain basically stuck in the App Store forever and it will never be able to be updated. So I'll give you some examples of apps where this has happened to. In the past, Skitch went from 4 plus to 17 plus. Textastic, which is a sort of programming text editor, which around which I built my entire workflow for teaching computer programming, that went from 4 plus to 17 plus rated. Even just this week, YouTube went from 4 plus to 17 plus rated, and the Google search app went to 17 plus rated. Now, these are four examples of apps that we have all deployed all across the school, YouTube being obviously quite a common one as well. And now I've got all those apps deployed and they're stuck in update, and we'll never get another update for them. And this is a huge pain. It means that the existing deployed apps will never get updated. And say a new student comes to the school, there's going to be some apps that they can never get that all the other people in their class have got at least an old version of, if not the current version. So the only workaround for this is to just stop restricting applications altogether, which is a huge pain and potentially opens the door to things that you genuinely don't want. Although I have to say, Bradley, I don't know if you agree with this, that the content of the 17 plus section of the App Store is much less objectionable today than it was 5 years ago. I don't know if you have that sense, but I certainly feel that way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because in reality, all that means. We've learned all that means is it has access to the web. And yeah. Because there's not porn in the App Store.
Yeah.
Not that porn is 17 plus, but yeah, you're not worried about porn apps in the App Store. So all that means is they have live access to the internet and a full web browser, but they already have that with Safari anyways.
But 5 years ago there were quote unquote lifestyle apps in the App Store. And this was back when we decided on this policy, which is quite old now. There certainly were applications in the 17 plus category that I did not want our students to be installing on their devices at all. But anyway, to bring it back to the question of blacklisting and whitelisting, what I would like to be able to do is to say by configuration that certain apps are always approved or certain apps are always denied, regardless of which age grouping they fall into. So I'll give you the counter example is Snapchat, which is only rated 12 plus, but I don't want our kids to install Snapchat. So I would like to be able to blacklist Snapchat, and I would like to be able to whitelist YouTube and Textastic and Skitch. And that's kind of what I'm looking for, right? I'm looking for the ability to be a bit more fine-grained about which apps can be installed and which apps can't. The age restriction works very well for the vast majority of things. But if, for example, there comes out a new app that's slightly problematic or people are abusing in a specific way, and it's not a networking app or whatever, maybe it's a game whose content is not particularly appropriate, and everybody suddenly starts playing it, I could say, well, look, this app is just not suitable for school. We're going to blacklist it. I don't necessarily think it would be a good idea to offer wildcards in here. I think administrators should have to say, specifically this app is okay, or specifically that app is not okay, and let the age ranges do the rest. But I think this is a live problem now, and it's becoming, because Apple, whenever any app can access the open web, Apple will slap a 17 plus rating on it, regardless of its intent or purpose. So how can a text editor be a 17 plus rated application? Well, the answer is because it's got an embedded web browser in it, therefore it's a 17 plus rated application.
Yeah, 17 plus means nothing to us.
Yeah, the category is now completely meaningless because all it means is quite useful in some respect, probably. I've certainly been emailing my contacts at Apple about this issue and, telling them, look, guys, this problem has broken 3 or 4 major workflows in the school now because you've taken these apps and you've taken them away by enforcing, and I know it's Apple that have enforced it, these 17 plus ratings on these developers for what are basically fairly innocuous apps. And, the practical impact of setting YouTube to be 17 plus on these devices is that the kids are still going to be able to access YouTube, but they're just going to have a worse experience because they've got to do it through Safari instead of through the native app, which is all the great features and different stuff that we can do. And potentially could give them fewer restrictions because, in principle, I don't know if this is even possible in practice, but in principle, if you were logged into the YouTube app through your Google Apps ID, there may be administrative controls that one could put in place. In principle, those could be built even if they don't exist right now. But making the app a 17 plus without thinking about a broader context is really painful. So if we had app whitelisting and blacklisting, I think that would neatly solve the problem. Apple could still put their general 17 plus rating on it, but I could say, well, we're already filtering the web in the way we filter the web, and I know that Textastic doesn't have a secret porn mode in it alongside the Ruby editing mode. So I'm going to be okay with that application. Whereas other ones, I might say, well, I don't want that regardless. So I think that, to me, that is another huge piece of low-hanging fruit for managed deployments, is being able to finesse your way around some of those rather crude age restrictions, and certainly the 17 plus restriction, as you said, Bradley, is the crudest of them all so far.
Yeah, it's like not the bully who cried wolf, but we're not even that pop up is meaningless to us now. It's like typing in your administrator password on the Mac. We just all do it because we're asked so many times. But yeah, I mean, it seems like the infrastructure is there. I mean, there's a way to search the App Store and the VPP portal, and it just seems like there's like all the pieces are in place for that. It just needs to somehow do it. And I don't know if it's, I guess that when a student searches the store, like it's going to have to, it could install anything, it would have to ping the MDM to see if this app was approved or something of that nature.
Yeah, well, the way I kind of envisage it is that it's a configuration profile that you would install on the device to say, on this device, you are allowed to have these specific apps, even if they don't match your age restriction. So the device could autonomously make that decision without having to go back to the MDM, because you could just put it out as a configuration profile. There are already things like this with the iOS 7 web filter, where you can actually go in the configuration profile, you can say these specific URLs are always allowed, or these specific URLs are always blacklisted. And basically what I'm seeing is the same kind of configuration profile options, but for App Store apps, bundle IDs probably, or maybe SKUs in the App Store.
Yeah, so a lot of things that we talked about here that would be great enhancements. Again, like we mentioned, these are certainly not to nitpick because we've come a long way, but the farther we get, the more we can dream.
Absolutely, yep. I'll let you know if I hear anything back about these things, but I guess not. So let's wrap up there, Bradley. I think that's all we've got for today. I've got your CSI Chattanooga story, so let us know if you get MD in jail for that.
Yeah, we'll do. I'll keep if you want, I'll post a link to some of the news stations in the show notes so you can see the surveillance footage. So if maybe it's a listener of the show that did it, ooh, that would be the best podcast story of all time.
Yeah,
maybe not.
I did a podcast and all I got was my iPad stolen.
Good t-shirt. Yeah. Well, the guy was wearing a hoodie that said "Live life to the lowest." One of the kids.
Oh well, he's living up to his mantra.
Good times. So, yeah, I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.